In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
We're pleased to bring you a special summer offer from our sister magazines. You can try 3 issues of BBC History Magazine or BBC History Revealed for just £5. That's a saving of up to 72% off the shop price. Plus, you'll receive free UK delivery on each issue. To find out more and take advantage of this offer, visit our official online store, buysubscriptions.com/podcast2021. If you're based in the US, you also won't miss out. You can try 3 issues for just $9.95, saving a huge 70%. For more details, visit buysubscriptions.com/podcast2021. Please be aware that both these offers end on the 31st of August 2021. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. From satirical cartoons of rotund imperialists to souvenir prints of Britain's heaviest man, our 18th century ancestors were fixated with images of fatness. But why? For today's podcast, I was joined by Dr. Freya Gowley, who's been researching how images of fat bodies were used to discuss the anxieties of the Georgian age. If you want to see some of the amazing images that we discuss in the following conversation, then we've posted some on our Instagram. Just follow us on History Extra to see those. So thanks very much for joining me, Freya. Today we're going to be talking all about your research into images and representations of fatness in the Georgian era. So why are you so interested in this? What can it tell us about society at the time?
Thanks, Ellie. And thanks for having me as well. Yeah, I guess I should start off by maybe explaining the use of terminology that we're using, which is using terms fatness and fat. And we are using those kind of as part of a reclamation of language that has occurred as the result of the body positivity movement, which has sort of reclaimed terms like fat and fatness. So we're sort of adhering to those standards. So part of the reason that I'm interested in looking at images of fatness is in part just because in contemporary society, we're so unused to seeing images of fat individuals in our daily lives. They don't necessarily appear on the covers of magazines. Sometimes they do, very rarely. Like there was a recent Cosmopolitan magazine cover in 2018, which featured a plus size model, and that was quite controversial. So actually, looking back to a period in which images of fatness were more routine is quite fascinating in terms of thinking about a long continuum of images of individuals with different kinds of body sizes and thinking about how those long legacies of ideas around fatness and body types first began, or and the negative associations that we often have with them and how those sort of emerged, how and when those things emerged.
So we're going to be delving into all of these in a bit more depth in a little while. But to start us off, can you give us an idea of some of the topics that fatness was used to discuss, as it were, in popular culture?
Fatness becomes so prevalent in the 18th century, in part because of something called the consumer revolution, which is a historian's term for the new emergence of goods of all kinds that really happens in the 18th century. So you have this new proliferation of consumable wares, which are available to purchase by an ever broader range of consumers. And so there's a lot of anxiety around that, and particularly over the nature of needs versus desires and how much consumption you should be doing and how much was too much. And so it made sense then that fatness would become kind of bound up with these moral conceptualizations of what we're consuming and what we're not consuming. And so fatness becomes, in this context in which luxury and overindulgence is really moralized. And so fatness becomes a byword for immorality of various kinds. So it crops up in discussions of transgressive behaviors of all kinds. So perhaps transgressions of expectations around gender and women's public appearances becomes a real issue. So if a woman was seen to be too public, she might be represented as fat. One good example of this is images of Albinia Hobart. So Albinia was Countess of Buckinghamshire, so an aristocratic woman, but she had a really interesting public role as a political hostess. So she canvassed on behalf of William Pitt the Younger in the Westminster election of 1784. So she was quite publicly visible, and also she engaged in gambling and private but somewhat public, the amateur theatricals. So she had quite a public reputation. And so she was often the subject of the satirist's pen. And part of the language around her presentation was around her body size. We don't know how big she was in reality, but certainly the visual culture that surrounds her suggests that she was larger than average, and therefore it becomes a way of lampooning her and drawing attention to those behaviors, those gendered behaviors that she shouldn't have been engaging in as a woman.
So it's kind of a weapon for misogyny, really.
Yes, it's certainly often directed towards women who go beyond the bounds of what was deemed acceptable feminine behaviour at the time. And I think we might come back to talk about Daniel Lambert later in the podcast, but certainly Lambert isn't treated with the same disdain that women like Albinia Hobart or Emma Hamilton, for example, are treated with.
This idea of using images of fatness as a way to critique people's morals, is that something new in the Georgian age, or is it kind of a more intense version of something that's gone before?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, historically, there have long been discomfort around weight being people being perceived as being overweight. But I think it's something that intensifies in this period specifically because of the rise of visual satire and its specific languages. So the Georgian era, we often think about, as I mentioned, as one of consumerism and new availability of different kinds of goods. But one of those kinds of goods was print culture of all kinds, so newspapers, ephemera, books, but also print visual images, so prints of various kinds. So that might be a representation after a famous portrait that's then available for sale to a broader range of consumers. But the kind of typical 18th century visual print that we think about is the satirical print. So the print which either gently or not so gently ridicules this kind of social mores of the day. So that might feature anything from commentary on contemporary politics, two gender roles and their transgression. So as I mentioned, so a good example of an event which generated a lot of satirical images is the 1784 Westminster election, which pitted Fox, Charles James Fox and William Pitt the Younger against each other. And Fox was one of the two sitting members for the constituency of Westminster, which had a large deal of political prestige at the time. So it was a very important seat. And so both sides of the campaign engaged in this quite bitter strategy of campaigning, libeling and slandering their opposition, and also engaging in engaging their famous friends in canvassing on their behalf. So one of the individuals that Fox gets to canvass is Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire. And so she is reported as touring the streets and campaigning on his behalf. And one probably apocryphal story about her kissing butchers emerges. And so that features repeatedly in prints. Some prints were made of this event that and were published every single day, which show Georgiana canvassing and engaging in these very public forms of behaviours. And she's sort of cast as being Fox's lover or a bad mother. And it's all because of this engagement with with this very public political world in which women were not supposed to participate. And so so you have this really intense culture of visual images, of satirical prints. And because satirical prints are so much about exaggeration as part of their humorous mode, it makes sense that sort of fatness becomes bound up with these narratives. If you have a remotely strong profile in visual satire, you're going to have your chin or your nose emphasized. And if you're even slightly over sort of average weight, you're going to be depicted as much larger than you are. So it just, it sort of, it makes sense that fatness becomes a focus of these kinds of images. So whereas there had long been various kinds of discomfort with fat bodies, I think it becomes a particular visual spectacle at this time, partly because of the kinds of models and modes that satire uses.
And how pervasive was this print culture, cartoons by the likes of, say, Gil Ray? Who would be seeing these images and where would they be seeing them? Did they reflect popular culture or was it more of a reflection of an aristocratic elite?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there is some debate amongst historians, as there always is, about who was the viewership for satirical prints. Certainly we know that certain forms of satirical print were much cheaper than other forms of high print culture. So if you were purchasing an image done, a very fine mezzotint done after an image by Joshua Reynolds of the Lady's Waldegrave or something, that's going to cost you much, much more than a satirical print by Gilray. Nevertheless, they're still quite elite objects. They're consumed by people like Horace Walpole, who keeps an album of satirical prints and pastes them all in. But there's also a sense in which these were publicly viewable by a broader range of society through the print shop window. And so one of the ways we know about this is through satirical images of people looking in print shop windows. So they're sort of a kind of witty play on the idea of the characters, the cast of characters who might be in these prints are then looking at themselves depicted in the print shop window. But there is a sense then for us as historians that this might have been a reality in which people of all kinds walking past would have seen and experienced these kinds of print on an everyday basis. So there's a potential that they were quite democratic as a medium.
So as well as the idea that fatness was used to portray moral laxity, as it were, you also look at how it was used to comment on imperialism, which is obviously a huge theme of this this era. How so?
Yeah, so fatness often crops up in visual images around the theme of imperialism. And this is for a couple of reasons. Inevitably, Britain's colonial expansion at this time brought British individuals into contact with other peoples with which British individuals had previously been unfamiliar. So the peoples who were enslaved and moved between Africa to the Caribbean, for example, and that just the peoples who were subjugated in the lands that were taken over as part of British imperialism. There's a lot of anxiety around British identity in this context, particularly around who was mixing with who and how these new landscapes might physically change the body as well. So fatness becomes this sort of shared language for reflecting on some of those anxieties. So whether through unflattering and often highly racist depictions of enslaved individuals who are shown as being unattractive and fat, or on the other hand, you might get depictions of settler colonists whose bodies are seen as becoming kind of lazy and softened as a result of the climate. So there's, because this is a time in which it's still quite a strong belief in the idea that your climate would affect you physically in quite specific ways. So fatness, as it often is bound up with these anxieties over this new of these new sorts of encounters, these new landscapes, these new geographies, and is used to express these anxieties. But this also plays into the broader narratives that we've been talking about around trade and consumerism as well. So individuals who are seen as importing luxury goods from abroad are often depicted as sort of luxuriating and fat and consuming, you know, Chinese punch bowls and wearing banyans imported from India. So it's quite a consistent reference point throughout these images.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
If we look at something like images of Albania participating in the Westminster election, we get a sense of just how many prints were available and how much people were consuming images like this as well. So it tells us not only about what Georgians were worried about, but the ways in which they were expressing those things as well.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
So far, all the touch points we've kind of had are fatness, seen very much in a negative sense. And I do want to talk about how it was seen in a positive sense in a moment. But just before we do, can you give us a sense of what the beauty ideals were at the time, maybe for men and women?
So certain historians have argued that this, particularly the end of the 18th century, so the time in which these satirical prints are becoming or reaching their height of popularity, that there's also a shift in beauty standards towards a thin body, specifically a consumptive body. So women who look like they might have tuberculosis specifically, so who would be very pale and pale, but with rosy cheeks, who would be very thin and would be quite like sort of diaphanously dressed, as was the style at the time, right? Those sort of Grecian flowing dresses. So there's a sort of a distinct shift towards this kind of feminine ideal where you're sort of shy and refined and thin, and it's all part of this, it's all bound up in this quite specific way. So you see this reflected in satires, but also in fashion plates where the kind of models are increasingly thin or very thin, and also in medical tracts, like something like William Wad's Cursory Remarks on Corpulence, which comes out in the early 19th century, which sort of really rails against weight gain and also will give recommendations for how to lose weight and what kinds of things you should be eating and stuff. So it's kind of early diet manual that we would sort of recognize today. So there's a real distinctive shift around this time to sort of valuing women's bodies that are thinner.
Do we have a sense of whether there's any kind of underlying historical reasons why that might have been the case? Or do you get the sense that, you know, trends come and go in terms of diet and beauty?
I think at the end of the 18th century and the early 19th century, specifically, it's partly about fashionability, what is trendy in terms of what women are wearing. But it's also about these sort of long-standing negative associations around fatness. But there's certainly a shift from what we might identify as sort of Renaissance plumpness to something more decidedly thin, and which is something we recognise as then having endured quite strongly into the Victorian period and into the present day as well. So it's certainly long-standing, but there's shifts and fluctuations throughout the history of ideal body types. But certainly it seems like this consumptive chic moment, as Carolyn Day has called it, is a bit of a turning point in this preferential shift towards thinness as the ideal for women.
Mm. And what about men? Did they have the same kind of pressures?
I mean, as is also sort of true today, there seems to be less discourse around whether men should be fat or not. I mean, obviously, everything in moderation. And so when you get to someone who is the size of Daniel Lambert, there's a lot more kind of moralizing around that. But certainly Charles James Fox is fat. You know, he has typical middle-aged spread, like a larger stomach. But that doesn't tend to be commented on so much, really, in the visual images. It's other things that he gets satirized for, like his eyebrows and his 5 o'clock shadow features very prominently. Whereas actually his weight is not so much a kind of point of satirization. And I think that is partly gendered as well. Mm. Because one of the concerns around women's bodies and being overweight was around pregnancy and fertility. So there was a perception, strong perception at the time, again, that is still very standard today, that women who are overweight in some way, which I'm quote unquote overweight, are less able to have children or are less fertile.
So I promised that we were going to talk about some more positive associations of fatness in the area. So let's talk about Daniel Lambert, who's come up a couple of times. What can you tell us about his life and then his larger than life persona as well?
Yeah, so Lambert is very much a kind of 18th century celebrity. He was known as Britain's largest man, and he's in part so famous because of his voluminous print culture that explodes around him. And it helps us to sort of understand the nature of celebrity at the time and how it was constructed through this consumption of visual images, but also about sort of changing attitudes towards fatness and how, and in many ways, that Lambert is something of an exception. So he was a Bridewell prison keeper and animal breeder, but he becomes famous, obviously, for the size of his body. He's born in Leicester in 1770, and by the time he's 23, he apparently weighed 32 stone, and by 1805, he was reputed to have weighed 50 stone. So he's fairly substantial as an individual. The prison eventually closes down in 1805, and he's granted an annuity to live on of £50. And he supplements this with sales of hunting dogs and fighting cocks, and crucially, by exhibiting himself in London. So this is quite interesting because of he has some real agency in this decision. This isn't something that is done to him. He's not subjected to this display. He sort of decides that he is a curiosity worthy of seeing, and he takes himself to London. And here he finds great fame. He's a popular attraction for the fashionable London elite, and he invites them to view him in his residence in Leicester Square, I think at first, and then there's also one at Piccadilly. He charges a shilling for entry as well. So quite lucrative. I believe it was often very busy. And so we get lots of accounts of people visiting him and conversing with him and having a rather engaging and lovely time. So one commentator said that the apartments of Lambert were more like that of a place of fashionable resort than of an exhibition. So when he puts himself on display in London, it's actually quite a refined display. I think it's very sociable. There's a kind of level of sociable exchange. He has enlightened kind of conversation with those who visit him. And he's sort of almost quite dandyish, I think, in the way he sort of presents himself while there. And as part of this reputation and fame that develops around him, we then get this rather substantial print culture. So there are prints of Lambert, which range from those that are quite fine in nature to very rough woodcuts, which suggests quite a broad range of society being interested in him. But they're not super satirical. They often resemble quite closely the couple of painted portraits we have of Lambert, which survive. And they don't tend to really exaggerate the size of his body more than what we see in the portrait itself as well. So he's certainly a kind of curiosity and is subject to some of those treatments, but he's certainly not a freak show in the Victorian sense of that terminology. So he actually has some real agency and celebrity and popularity, and I think that's sort of interesting to think about.
Yeah, and something I was really interested to learn about was the way in which Daniel Lambert became essentially a bastion of Englishness, didn't he? How was that connection formed?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. So often in the more satirical images that do emerge of Lambert, he's cast in the role of John Bull, so the personification of Englishness from this time, who himself is repeatedly quite rotund and sort of he represents this sort of healthy, labouring body, slightly plump, but still very strong kind of British moral character. And so Lambert sort of often assumes that role, or he might be depicted with John Bull. And that is specifically around this time in that becomes such a thing in direct relation to ideas of Frenchness. So in one image, Lambert fulfills the role of Bull in opposition to Napoleon, who's depicted as much smaller and thinner and scrawnier. But that was part of an established visual language that really emerged as a result of the French Revolution and British anxieties around how the French had behaved. There's an internal perception in France at the time that obviously this was a period of great freedom, of great kind of freedom from existing tyrannies. But the British were quite critical of this and portrayed the French as extremely thin and malnourished and as a kind of comment on the failure of the French Revolution, really. So when Lambert appears as John Bull, or when John Bull appears again as a kind of rotund, healthy, plump, nourished British man, this is in opposition to a less healthy French man who's malnourished, and then it's just therefore a comment on kind of national character as well. So it kind of works on lots of different levels.
But one thing I did want to ask you is just what you've been most surprised by to uncover in your research in terms of attitudes to fatness that we might find quite alien today.
Yeah, I think that certainly the sort of valorization around Daniel Lambert, I think, is the most surprising thing. I think if you compare it to something like those awful My 600 Pound Life TV shows or something like that, in which extremes of fatness are treated with disdain and as a spectacle, but not in a way that grants the individual any agency, it's sort of refreshing to see Lambert have like a real sense of self, to take on roles as a businessman. He's actually often discussed as a sort of paragon of sporting expertise. He's well known for horse riding. And there's a one story in this biography, which must be completely made up, but is quite wonderful, which talks about him wrestling a bear and then winning. So there's all this sort of mythologization around Lambert, which is very positive in nature. It's quite distinctive from the models through which we sort of understand and experience fatness today. I mean, obviously that was one of the narratives that came through as part of the coronavirus pandemic, was quite there was a lot of sort of fat phobia that came around during that. And that was when I was really sort of working on this material, and I was thinking how distinct the two approaches were, thinking about how Lambert was celebrated and how if there was an equivalent to him today, I could not imagine the same being true.
Why do you think that this is all important to us as historians to know about? How does it offer new insights on the Georgians and Georgian society?
Yeah, so I think that this topic is important both for understanding the Georgians and longer legacies of fatness and how it's been treated throughout history and how it's a cultural construction, really. But for me, fatness is such a useful window onto a range of interconnected issues. So it tells us not only about anxieties around things like gender, sexuality, imperialism, all the things that Georgians were worried about, and due to big shifts in, you know, commercialism and women's role within society and things like that. But it also tells us about some of the modes of culture and how, you know, how images worked at this time. So we understand more about, you know, proliferation of images. If we look at something like images of Albania participating in the Westminster election, we get a sense of just how many prints were available and how much people were consuming images like this as well. So it tells us not only about what Georgians were worried about, but the ways in which they were expressing those things as well. And then at the same time, I think it helps us to think about the idea of fatness as being a cultural construct. So not just something which is sort of medicalized and discussed of in terms of something like obesity, but actually, you know, that these are long-standing legacies with highly kind of cultural traditions. And so it's important to understand current attitudes through this longer continuum of attitudes.
Thank you so much. I think that would be a great place to end. I mean, it all feels so, you scroll through Instagram and you, the idea of the proliferation of images, it all feels very familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think, and it's interesting that part of the way in which the body positivity movement has really come into sort of popularity is partly through social media and through other forms of media that are not like traditional magazines, images of bodies and things like that. So I think there's lots of interesting continuums to think about how fatness is so associated with visual culture specifically.
That was Dr. Freya Gowley. Freya has written an article on this subject for the September issue of BBC History magazine. That's on sale on the 5th of August and also includes features on the Salem witch trials, the workhouse, the far-right hijacking of the classics, and much more. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley. Tune in tomorrow when David Goldblatt will be answering your questions on the history of the Olympics.